Hello and welcome to episode 115 of Beekeeping at Five Apple Farm. This is Lee. Happy March to you all. Please pardon this little add-in, listeners, but this podcast was recorded in early March and due to a technical problem, I couldn't post it till now. I just wanted to tell you to adjust the timing when you listen to it for about March 1st. All right, thanks. Wherever you are listening, I know there is probably a huge range of weather going on. When I think of different parts of the country, I hear from listeners from. Have had some great conversations this week with some patrons, some from Texas and California and West Virginia. It's such a treat. I thank you all for being here. Today is pretty casual. I just wanted to talk to you about some of the things perhaps to think about as we get into spring in whatever form you are going to encounter it. We're not quite in spring yet here in Western North Carolina, though certain days would sure fool you. We've got daffodils. The red maples are just on the verge of blooming up here in the higher mountains around 3,000 feet, to my amazement. It seems early to me, but maybe it's actually not. The bees are going crazy out there. I've heard some people in the area already talk about reversing boxes. I'm a little hesitant to, I'm not so much on reversing in the traditional fashion. So for anyone that's new, there's a technique that often happens, particularly in larger commercial yards, that overwinter bees, say, let's say in two deep brood boxes. So what will happen is at whatever point in the spring that the bees are really filling up that top box because they've probably moved upward to that, then the beekeeper may come along and just flip those boxes. So put the bottom box on top of the box that has all the bees in it. And that instantly doubles the room they have, because as you know, the bees are not as prone to move downward in the hive. There can be tons of open comb boxes beneath them, but in the spring, they're really determined to move up. And when they hit the top, then you begin the earliest stages of swarm preparation. Now, just keep in mind, if you are not in swarm season yet, if there's not a major flow coming up very shortly, then you don't have to worry so much. I mean, the bees will snuggle in that top box. In fact, in that case, the main concern, and this is something I hope everyone is checking on, is making sure they don't run out of food, because the amount of honey they burn through once there's brood in that box is exponential compared to the amount of honey they went through when there's no brood or very little brood in the winter. It is very easy for them to run out of food, and because of the demands of feeding that brood, it is extremely easy for them to starve or to just get really stressed. And stress, when they have all that new brood in the spring, it can lead to things like European foul brood, just all kinds of problems. So I am all about finding ways to lessen the stress on the bees in this stressful world that we all live in, with the up and down weather and erratic weather patterns as well. So in my apiary, they're definitely getting brooded up for sure. Lots of coming and going. They're bringing in pollen. We had a great chat on the little text exchange with a few people that I have in my local club. We've had a text exchange going for a while, and it's so fun because, you know, we'll report back on, you know, somebody drives to Asheville to go do something, and there's a report back on, you know, what the maples are doing along the interstate and where we're seeing maples actually blooming so we can watch it happen. The spring kind of comes up the mountain slowly. And there's actually an exact calculation that's pretty fascinating, and I can't remember that kind of math, but there's a pretty exact equation of how quickly the blooms move up the mountains, and it has to do with the elevation change and how much time that is. So, for example, Marion, North Carolina is down the hill from us. And it's fascinating because I follow some of the clubs down there. Well, the club down there, it's a pretty large one. Some of the members will talk about where they are. And I just make a mental note because where I am is at least 2 weeks behind them, sometimes more. But It's just fun. And that is a neat thing to keep up with if whatever social media you're on, if you observe the bee clubs just south of you or just warmer than you, in this case, warmer than me, it gives you a little heads up. It gives you a little heads up to start preparing. Just don't jump the gun, because you've got to follow what's going on, not only in your weather, in your microclimate, but also your particular bees. Friends of mine who have bees that are more Italian stock, they're way out ahead of mine. And I don't mind that, because one of the beauties of the Carniolan lines is that they kind of hold their fire, and then they boom like crazy. So you just have to be ready for these bees to boom all of a sudden. Once that flow starts, it's just unreal how quickly they build up. The Italians seem to start building up way earlier. I know a lot of people, I've heard this a lot lately, are like, oh, you know, the lines of the bees, they're all so mixed up. How does it doesn't really matter. And I disagree, because I see definite differences between my lines of bees and bees that my friends keep, even though in some cases we've kind of mixed them up. But there are some real tendencies that are clear to observe in the different lines of bees if you take the time to actually observe. I want to just a moment talk about an email I got from a listener. They didn't share their name, but they sent a message and said, I like the podcast, but I really dislike the way, I'm paraphrasing here, I really dislike when you call people, new beekeepers, beginners. And they said, because some beginners have really put the study in. And to this I say, yes, I have a bee friend who is technically speaking a beginner, only a couple of years in, but has put so much work, has worked so many hives, has done so much with the club and other people's bees and learning and studying, that when I talk to her, I do not feel like I'm talking to a beginner. But I will say that is extremely unusual. In fact, that's the only person I've ever known in my beekeeping time that advanced so quickly, because that's what they're doing. They're into it. So they're definitely learning in dog years. But I think what's more typical, especially if a person is just starting out with a couple of hives, and frankly, I'm just going to put it out there, you need to start out with at least two hives. There's just no getting around it. One hive, you are just dooming yourself to all kinds of difficult challenges. Anyway, I'll go into that later. And if I forget, y'all, somebody remind me. But I want to speak to this listener and anyone who might feel the same. When I use the term beginner, I do not mean any disrespect. That is simply a person who is newly started in bees. And when you are newly started, it is very difficult to even fathom what you don't understand yet. The only thing that I've ever heard that comes close to it, of the things that I know, is to hear parents of many children talk about how different it is with their later children versus that first baby, and how they thought and worried and did things so different. And then by the fourth baby, they've got their skills down, and things that were incredibly hard or stressful or worrisome about that first baby, they're not worried about. I mean, there may be other things to worry about, but it really changes. So being a beginner is not an insult. It is a beautiful place to be. That said, as a beginner, one of the most important pieces of information you can have is to know that you're a beginner, is to know not to expect too much of yourself. There will be texts that you open up to read about bees, and you read it and you're like, this makes absolutely no sense to me. A wise beginner will tell themselves, okay, I'm going to learn enough so that what I've just read will make sense. Or they kind of recommit. It's like, I want to be a beekeeper long enough where I can read an article like that and every word I get. But if you feel bad about being a beginner, if you feel like, God, I should know all this stuff to be a beekeeper, Well, yeah, you should, but there is only one way to learn all that stuff, and that is to do beekeeping. I'm a huge fan of study. In fact, I'm a huge proponent of study. And as y'all know from hearing me talk on here, I'm all about, you know, look it up, study, read a book, talk to your mentor, go to a club, listen to a talk, all those things, because it will help you learn 1,000 times faster than simply going out by yourself with your couple hives of bees and trying to figure it out. I'm not saying it's not possible, but you can also dig a ditch with a teaspoon, but you might want a better tool. So beginners, please don't feel like I am talking down to you when I use that term, but there is a true difference between a beginner, an intermediate, and an experienced beekeeper. And knowing that, knowing what your level is, I mean, that's as important as if you were going to go sign up for a class in math, say, God forbid. You know, you would need to know what your level of math is. There would need to be some type of test you took on the beginning to go, okay, here's my level of math, so that you could slide into a class that matches you where you are and then go from there. So I just want to put that out there. And I hope that person is still listening and keeps listening and goes from a beginner to intermediate to advanced, because there is no greater joy. And I can say this from lived experience. There is no greater joy in beekeeping than running into all kinds of puzzles and having a good idea of the tools that you could use to work your way out of that puzzle. It is thrilling. It is worth it. It is worth all the reading and study and all the boring talks at bee clubs that you have to go through and all the not so enjoyable conversations you might have with some beekeepers in order to get that tip that just helps you go to the next level. I'll give you one little example, because I also want to remind you of this tool in your toolbox. Michael Bush called it the panacea cure, and it's the thing you do if you ever open a hive and look at a colony and you're like, oh my gosh, I don't see any brood, or I see, you know, no new brood. I can't find the queen. Maybe they look kind of jumpy and buzzy when you go in there, and you're like, for whatever reason, they appear to have gone queenless. There are times of the year that hive, that colony, will look queenless, and it is most certainly not. They could be doing, there's about five things they could be doing or in the process of doing or just about to do, that if you go and buy a mated queen and put it in there, you've just wasted that many dollars, because the test for finding out what's going on with the test for finding out what might be going on with a colony that appears to be queenless is a frame of eggs and open brood. Take a frame from another hive, shake the bees off, put it in your hive, your puzzler hive, and then watch what they do. If you go back in 5 days or 4 days, and they, well, you could go back in probably in 3 days, but 3 to 5 days, and they've started queen cells, then they need a queen. And at that point, you might not even want them to raise a queen. Like right now, I saw a post on social media where someone was looking for a queen as soon as possible because they had a colony that had gone queenless. Now, I don't know if they checked, and I don't know if that colony is really queenless, but they were looking to buy a caged mated queen from somewhere. And if that hive is truly queenless, then that's an option. Another option for them might be to simply combine with another hive. So you see how critical. If they just had one hive, they'd be up the creek right now. But if you've got two hives, you can go, you know, okay, this hive I've tested, they're definitely queenless. Maybe there's not enough bees in there to be a great colony. Maybe it's definitely not the right time of the year, at least here in the mountains, definitely not time to let colony raise their own queen. Not that they couldn't, but because there are not enough flying drones out there to get a queen well mated. The other thing about getting a queen well mated, if they're making their own, is flying weather. And our weather, we have these beautiful days. And if the queen happened to go out on her mating flight on those days, if there were drones out there, which is very questionable, at least where I am. Now, people in other apiaries in Yancey County are seeing flying drones and seeing a good amount of drones walking around in their hives. I still, in my opinion, I would never try to get a queen mated yet. The best queen mating weather is when the bees will be naturally swarming. When the bees are wanting to naturally swarm, they tend to know there's enough boys out there to get it done. So always remember to check the bee timetable. You know, when would they do this if everything was going right? So if it's gone queenless, then everything is not going right. So the options available to that person are indeed getting a mated queen from somewhere probably further south, but sometimes you have to do that if you need an emergency queen. If that person had had some overwintered nucs that they had kept going over the winter, then the solution is the easiest thing in the world. Once they verified that hive is queenless, you simply take one of your nucs and you do a newspaper combine with that queenless hive, and boom, you've got a much bigger colony because you've combined them, and they have a young, robust queen because you overwintered one of those queens that was just a baby back in the late summer, early fall. And that's a best case scenario. That alone is reason enough, in my opinion, to learn the art of making late summer nucs and overwintering them, figuring out whatever it takes to overwinter them in your climate and have them in the spring. And listen, they can be overwintered outdoors in most any climate based on what I see. I've been figuring out ways to overwinter mine right this minute. Well, actually, since the beginning of the year when we really had some cold spells, I will confess I have some little overwintered hives that were just really way too small to survive the winter, but I've made them a pet project. And so on nights when it goes down below 25, I just pick them up and I put them in my basement that happens to keep a lovely root cellar temperature. And they sit it out for a few polar nights. And then as soon as it warms back up, I go out and put them in the same spot. Getting them back in the same spot is really, really important. But I've also seen and hope to get some speakers on here that are going to talk about this. Overwintered nucs, usually done in groups. So they kind of, what is that called? They gang them or make it like a section of townhouses with an insulation on the outside of groups of nucs. They really need that. The way that has worked really well for me is the penthouse nuc, and that's where I put a nuc over a double screen board and over a slim quilt box. And that little addition of the slim quilt box keeps the moisture from the lower hive of going up and just swamping that little penthouse on the top. The downside to that is if you need to do anything to the hive underneath, it's kind of a pain in the butt. I mean, you can't just to check the stores of the larger hive down below, you can't just tip the thing because you've got another nuc on top. And so you really do have to set it up with, be sure to set it up. This is what I do. I duct tape the double screen board to the box on top that is my nuc. And that way I can lift it off, set it aside, quickly do whatever I need to the hive below, check their stores. If they are low on stores, then, for example, I could add a sugar brick or a winter patty and then put the quilt box back on and get the little penthouse back on there before they all get confused and the little penthouse bees start trying to go into the bigger hive, which will be, of course, certain death. But the one little penthouse I did this winter, I mean, they were such a just... If there's such thing as a Hail Mary nuc, that's what they were. So tiny. And it was like, well, heck, I'll just stick them on top of this really big bubba hive and see what happens. Well, and the other thing is I have not brought them in. I just could not manage because if I took them off of that hive, then I would have to set up insulation on top for the hive below, which I didn't have. I didn't have anything set up for them. So And also the insulation board that I have on the sides goes the full length. So if I take that penthouse nuc off, then it's a box. It's not a nuc box. It's just a 8-frame medium box. Then the insulation's wrong and I can't get the top cover back on the lower hive. So the last stretch of days, it was below 20 here and we had about 3 nights of it. I just had to wish them luck and leave them out there. And to my amazement, they are still alive. You know, that is a huge testament to that big colony below, sending up heat, which gently goes through that thin quilt box, which is just, it's probably about a 3-inch shim filled with wood shavings. And then there's the little nuke set on top. And like I said, everything has, they have extremely extremely thick top insulation. And then the whole hive stand has probably, it's at least 2-inch foam board on three sides. I don't put foam board on the front of the colonies that face, I mean, of the hives that face south, because, I mean, and, you know, I'm just making this up as I go, but whatever works, I keep doing it. And so I just have put three sides of the foam board. And what happens is it doesn't take that much sun to really warm them up. Now, we're not having heat here. It's not that kind of climate, but a little bit of sun will warm them up and they are able to move around in the hive freely and get the honey to where they need it, which is so important if on those cold nights or cold stretches of nights or long stretches of chilly rain where they just don't, they can't move around as freely as they might need to go fetch food to get it closer to where the cluster or where the brood nest is. This is also the time of year, because of my particular microclimate, where in addition to just making sure they have food, that's just, if you haven't checked weights, please go out today or as soon as you can and check weights if you're in an area where they've already started to brood up, because it is so dramatic, the weight loss of the hives. But other than that, what I am doing is trying to make sure that they have plenty to eat and pollen in the hive, even for those days, which we can have lots of days and lots of hours that it's too chilly or windy or rainy for them to fly. So now I'm not doing pollen patties yet. So pollen patties are the higher protein patties, the ones that are notorious for getting small hive beetle. And then of course the winter patties have less protein and those are for the winter. So they really count as the sugar carb needs for the hive. So I'm making sure they have access to that inside the hive for all that time that they can't possibly be getting out there to find what few maples that I might have blooming in the area. Let me stop for a second there. One of my long-term wonderful listeners, Jeff. Thank you, Jeff. Wrote in on Patreon to say that he had noticed he got some small hive beetle larvae in his winter patties that he had on hives. Now he's in more toward eastern North Carolina, so it's a couple steps warmer than here. But I found that too. There was one of the little sandwich containers that I used to put winter patty in. And when I was checking it, I'm like, oh no, you know, there were those gross, tiny, small hive beetle larvae in there. So what I have done, and actually I started doing this year based on that experience last year, was the quantity of winter patty that I put on there, and this applies to pollen patty in the spring as well, is very small. Basically, I want them to be able to eat it before any hive beetle that's overwintered in that hive can get up there, do their thing, lay eggs, larvae, and all that happen. And as long as I'm in there, like the one that I found that there was larvae, I just cleaned it all up, got it out, you know, scooped it out of that portion of winter patty. The part that I could salvage, I put in the deep freeze to make sure it has kind of been cleansed of any eggs that are still in there. It's still good for the bees because the little larvae didn't get very far. They were just in the little tiny gross worm stage. And I put a fresh sandwich container with winter patty back on that hive. And also, because it's a smaller hive, I cut back on the portion that I gave them. Now, this means I have to check more often. But, you know, beekeeping is always walking that razor's edge between too much and too little, too soon and too late. Gosh, it is merciless in terms of of balance. You have to get it balanced. You won't always get it balanced. Don't expect that of yourself. I mean, part of what you are as a beekeeper is the person to help right the balance in your apiary of whatever gets out of balance. And that's really your role of tweaking and changing and helping and just helping the bees stay in balance. And I'm not talking about propping bees up or doing extreme measures to prop up or save a hive that's dying or just can't thrive or whatever. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the basic care that you give colonies that makes you a beekeeper. If you have colonies that you give no care to, you're not really a beekeeper. I'm not going to call anybody any of the kind of noxious names that get called, but that is not really beekeeping. Beekeeping is an art. It's the art that's done by the human involved with the bees. There are indeed other ways to be with bees, and many people choose to do that. And hey, you be you, as they say. But what I've found is the most satisfying and successful way to be a beekeeper for me is to be involved, to be a force for good in my apiary, to not stress the bees with my manipulations or my expectations from them to make bees or make nukes or make honey, not to stress them too badly with that, not to stress them with bad beekeeping. Now, I do. I still do. I am human. Oh, so human. But I try not to. And when I do a stupid thing, I try to fix it as soon as I can. And I try to learn from it. So being an active beekeeper, it is scary at first. And kind of back to that know you're a beginner thing. Know you might be scared at first. You might be scared to do a deep dive into a big overwintered hive that's coming out of winter, big and robust. It's scary, especially the first time. It's probably, I mean, I was basically terrified every time I opened a beehive for the first 4 years that I kept bees. I was basically in a state of anxiety and terror every moment I was working bees because I knew I didn't know enough to be a good beekeeper. But I loved the bees. I loved them so much. I wanted so much to become a good beekeeper. So it's not always fun for those first years. Sometimes it is just showing up and doing the reps. As my personal trainer has taught me, you just show up and you do the reps and something happens. And you do not do it only if you feel like it or you just do it. And I can't believe the things I'm learning from a personal trainer, how much that applies to beekeeping. It's kind of funny, actually. So that's a way of saying the other thing I like to do because of the climate here. And if you happen to be in one of those climates that is fickle, can really change, is mercurial. I think that's the word, up and down, makes changes fast. Can be rainy and cold one day and then sunny and beautiful for days. And then you get a snow or an ice or high winds, any of that. So I have to kind of be ready for any of the seasons of the year can occur in a North Carolina mountain winter, especially now. And you just have to be prepared to not fall for it, to not fall. A friend and I used to call we would often get this week of just sunny spring weather that would happen in early February, and we'd call it faux spring. It is faux spring. It is fake spring. It's a tease. It's spring just seeing if you know your stuff in gardening or bees enough to hold back and not do anything silly. So at my elevation, it is tentative spring. It is not spring yet, but the bees are getting ready. And once those maples really start happening, the bees will go crazy if it corresponds to a stretch of warm, sunny weather. If the maples bloom their hearts out and we have a stretch of chilly, rainy, windy weather, the bees will not be able to get to it. And this is another reason to really be aware of what is going on in your local area. And I've just found no better resource than to get to know local beekeepers who've been doing it a long time, because you might not agree on another thing about beekeeping, but if they know the bloom schedule of your area, they are worth putting up with long enough to learn the bloom schedule for your area, because it will influence everything you do in beekeeping, in knowing what's about to happen. Just like I know that when that maple comes on, if we have warm, sunny weather, then I have got to jump out there and prevent swarms, because I am conservative about doing splits. I tend to wait later than most of my beekeeping friends. Part of that is because I don't make a living from my bees. So if I lose a swarm or two, well, good lesson learned. Maybe I'll catch them. Maybe I won't. But I would so rather lose a swarm or two from my yard than to stress my entire yard by doing reversing or doing splits too early. So back to reversing. That's the technique. It's a swarm prevention technique. You know, a split is not really a swarm prevention technique. A split is a technique to get more bees, to make another colony. So swarm prevention techniques, the absolute best one I have personally found. Now, remember, I use 8-frame mediums, so they're little short frames if you're doing deeps in your brood box. But it is very possible for in the next few weeks, for sure, couple weeks maybe, for me to take off a bottom box of that hive. It's probably empty. They're probably just walking up through it to get up to the top. It's going to be full of drawn comb. At that time, I will purge some of the comb. If it's really black, I'm going to either find some drawn comb in my shed to replace it with. That's the best case scenario, because we're not in wax drawing weather either. So if I put foundation above their heads, that is nothing. That is just a drafty attic with the attic door open, sucking all the heat out of the house. So if I find get that lower box with an 8-frame medium, when I quote unquote reverse, really I'm just taking a bottom box off and putting on the top. It doesn't create a huge amount of space the way that if you took a 10-frame deep brood box and put it on top of your 10-frame box that has the brood nest in it. I mean, let's say they're going great in there. They've got 6 good frames of brood and enough bees, mostly to cover all that brood in case of a cold night or a hard freeze. But if you take that deep brood box and you put that giant open space above them, what is more likely to happen in my location is that it sucks the heat up to the top of the hive again. That's one of the reasons why they're up tops, because that's where the warmth is. And that is the warmth they need to keep those Florida temperatures inside that brood nest in order for the brood to survive. So I've just created, it's like a person's trying to keep warm in their house, and I went over to their house and opened all the doors and windows. That's what you're doing if you reverse too early or with too small of a population of bees. What I strongly prefer to do is to do the technique called opening the brood nest. And that is, as you notice, the brood nest that they make, it is compact. It is usually right in the middle. I mean, sometimes they can be over to the left or the right, but somewhere right around the center. And maybe there's a few frames of brood, and maybe they're fenced in up there with honey that they still have. And so you're like, ooh, they're crowded, and they're up at the top of the box. But you know you do not have enough bees to fully cover a second open brood box. And so what I like to do is take those frames with brood. Now, even this, you have to do carefully, because any time you are adding space to the brood nest or space to the whole hive, you have to look at your bee population, because if they've gone crazy and they've created so much brood that on a cold freezing night, they're only going to be able to salvage maybe the middle of it. If the population of the adult bees is big enough to thickly cover every frame in your box, I mean thickly cover every frame, then it is time to move fast on expanding the brood nest. If it's just one of those, ooh, they're starting to kind of get crowded in there, then for me, a technique that has worked great is to take a couple frames of drawn comb and separate those brood frames enough that I put the drawn comb in there. It has to be done carefully because, again, I need enough bees in that box to thickly cover every single frame that I'm expecting them to keep as a brood nest. And if they can, then what you've done is you've given the queen more space to lay. She will keep laying. She will keep advancing toward that full spring, summer laying rate, and she'll fill up those combs in no time. That keeps her satisfied because she knows she needs to lay. That keeps her happy. It keeps the nurse bees satisfied because she's laying at a rate that they read as, hey, everything is going right. We've got a healthy queen. She's laying enough. We've got enough room. Then they don't get in the mood to go somewhere as much as they do as when they start getting crowded. One of the big signs, in fact, a kind of last minute sign, if you see them starting to pack the brood nest with nectar, once you have a nectar flow on, if you pull out a brood frame and you look in there and you're like, huh, look at all this brood and huh, look at all these shiny cells of nectar mixed in with all my brood. Now there'll be some, but if you start seeing that as a pattern, they are backfilling the brood nest, and that is a strong sign they are in swarm preparation. Preparation to swarm starts, I would say, 2 to 3 weeks before the swarm. Probably longer, but at least 2 or 3 weeks before the swarm. So with experience, you do get to where you start, you can start to see them start to think about it. You can read it in their little bee eyes. When you look at them, they are starting to think of swarming. It's really not. But what you're looking is signs of what they're doing. So population is a sign. If you open that box on a day, maybe not the hottest day, but maybe a medium temperature day, and you just can't even see wood on the top. You can't even see the wood on the top of those frames. Then yeah, they may have a good population. It is pretty eye-opening how a population can spread out and look bigger than they are on a really warm day. Because maybe it's not full flying weather. Maybe a lot of those are foragers that just can't quite get out on that day. And if we could see them easily, and oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could, if we could see them easily on that cold night that's going to come that night, if you're in a climate that it does that, it is striking how tight they can constrict into a cluster on a cold night and versus how much they look like on a warm day. And that's that balance that, and figuring that, knowing that only comes with experience. And if you are a beekeeper that's new and that maybe you only have two hives, maybe you only have 1 year experience, then it is so wonderful to volunteer yourself to go help work hives in an experienced beekeeper's yard. Again, you may not agree with any of the way they keep bees. Maybe they're a sideliner that does things basically commercial style. So maybe they do go through every hive, look at them, decide whether to reverse boxes. But as you do that, even if you're like, oh, I don't know if I'd do this, but even as you do it and you hear what they're looking for, you will learn stuff. My local club, due to the incredible work of the officers, is about to have a teaching apiary. It will be up at the Mayland campus in Mitchell County, and it's going to be a teaching apiary. I am so thrilled about this because that is such a thing for a teaching apiary for a club is such a leap in what we can do for newer beekeepers, especially. Not only does it give experienced beekeepers reason to improve their teaching skills, you know, to go, there's so many really experienced beekeepers. I mean, who could beekeep me under the table? But they haven't talked about it to anybody, you know, so they know they do it and they know it works, but they can't talk to you about why and about how do they know when to do this thing. So that's a whole different skill. Some of the most talky beekeepers may be ones without solid experience, because an experienced beekeeper usually has a certain amount of humility about them. And if you have a person who's just absolutely sure, this always works, I know this for sure, you know, maybe, but always take things with a grain of salt. If a friend of mine was writing a little brochure that she gives to the people she mentors, and basically she just put it out there, and I greatly admire this, that, you know, really be careful taking bee advice from anybody who cannot say that they have successfully overwintered their bees for several years. I think she put 5, which I thought was a good number. I mean, there are people who could be very helpful, like in that third or fourth year, if they've really been paying attention to it. But 5 is a good safe number. And you know, I am just a jerk about it. When I was a new beekeeper, once I realized this, once I'd been given bad advice by people that I thought knew bees, maybe they're like, yeah, I've been doing bees for 8 years. And then, you know, the question I didn't know at that time to ask was, oh, how many years in a row have you successfully overwintered your bees? And to my horror, what I realized was there are many beekeepers who have massive die-offs and buy more packages and nukes the next year. So they might have 10 years of beekeeping experience, but if they haven't been able to successfully overwinter their bees for a few to several years, then in my opinion, I'm going to take everything they say with a lot of caution and a big old grain of salt. Okay, so I've gotten way off on my soapbox, and I apologize that. And I apologize for that. So I have a couple things to tell y'all. Now, patrons, I'm going to do, for you guys, I thought a way to say thank you for keeping this podcast on the air, for supporting me so that I can do this for these hours and keeping the lights on of the podcast itself. I'm going to start doing detailed show notes when I post for the patrons. And so on Patreon, you get an RSS feed that you can listen to both the public podcast as well as the private podcast. And then also I can post on there like a blog post, notes and pictures and videos and things to you guys. So what I am going to start doing is the episode posts on Patreon. I used to have them open to everyone, but they will be just for patrons because I'm going to put some effort into a patron exclusive detailed show notes. Now, I will definitely still be putting show notes on the public podcast, so no worries there, guys. I want to just go that extra mile for the patrons because they go that extra mile for me. For example, I hope you all are starting to get ready to split. Now, not yet. Not yet if you're in where I am or colder, but some of you are in warmer areas and it might be swarm season already in some of the listener areas. So I just wanted to say, back in this podcast, there's episodes that I have talked about splitting in depth. And so I wanted to name those for you and patrons, I'll put links up for you. And that is episode 60, I talk about splitting. Episode 85, I talk about splitting. Episode 99, I talk about splitting. And episode 109 is the part A of the two-part show that never got a part B. And so what I'm going to do next for you is to start the part B of, and it might be B, C, D, and E of episode 109, because that's the core of what I am trying so hard to get the booklet, the recipe booklet of splits done for you guys. I was in a deep funk over the winter and I just did not make the progress on it that I had hoped, but it's in process. And so before I get that out, I'm going to be talking about each of the specialty splits that I like, what I like about them, etc. Now, one thing, please remember when you go back and listen to those podcasts, and a lot of those I just rave about. I say the cut down split is my favorite split. It's hard. I mean, it's harder than most. You have to basically divide up two hives into their components. The queen has to go a certain place. The cap brood has to go a certain place. The open brood has to go a certain place. Each of the new hive has to go a certain place and on and on. So it is complicated. Now, for those of you who are more advanced and who want a split method that you really can get honey from, you can get honey and bees from a cut down split. I have proven this to myself over and over. And actually you can get it from both halves, both the portion of the cut down that does not have the queen initially. That's your number one honeymaker, because they're not going to have any brood. And they're just, if you do it at the right moment before the flow, they will fill that hive up with honey. then the other half that is, you know, that went, we lost all their flightless bees when we moved them to a different part in the same apiary. But that queen is still going, and they are still raising brood. And as long as you keep them fed, then it won't take that long for them to rebuild into a colony that, if you have any late season flows, depending on where you are, that they do that in time for a late season flow. And so you can actually get honey. You know, I'm not talking about 5 supers full of honey, but you can get an amazing amount of honey and also get new queens, make nukes, all that kind of stuff. So that is the cut down, but it is complicated. I no longer suggest it to even young intermediate, I mean, young in their beekeeping years, intermediate beekeepers, because it's a big pain in the butt. And if you're not really pushing to get all those things, if it's not vital that you get honey to harvest from the same hive that you're making a split with, then I don't recommend it anymore, because I have found a split, thanks to Ange Roll and Tina Sebastian and the many other beekeepers who have pioneered this. I've found the split that I use most often is essentially what Ange Roll describes as the runaway split. Tina Sebastian of Colorado calls it, and I did an episode with her, but I don't know how much we talked about her split, but I will put a link to her excellent article about this split. She calls it a reverse Doolittle split, because there's a Doolittle split, and she calls this a reverse Doolittle. It's slightly different than the runaway, but the concept that you use for that, and it can be a flyback split from Laurie Miller, but that set of splits, it does everything I need it to do. I can get all the bees I need. I can get all the honey I need, just because I don't need to sell any particular amount of honey. I'm going to talk about it first. It's going to be the first split I talk about, because I have modified it with my habit of wanting the most queens from one split. And so I have made up a queen maker variation on the runaway split. And if y'all have a good name for that, after that episode, you tell me so we can give it a catchy name and it can be its own thing. And then the other split that I use most often is the nucleus split. And one of those episodes I just mentioned, I don't have it in front of me, is exclusively about using the nucleus split. And that is where you just pull the old queen, staff and stores, to a nuke box, and you either take it to a different yard, or if you have to get more bees in there to do this, you can even leave it in the same apiary. And so that way, the remainder of the original hive is going to be requeening. That's a very, very handy technique as well. You can get a lot of queens. If you do it right, you can get a lot of queens and then bust it all up to several nukes at the end. It's a great easy split. There is also directions for the nucleus split on the Apiarist Scottish Beekeeping blog that I will also put up a link for. So thank you to all you listeners. Thank you to you listeners who are still showing up. Some of you may have lost all your bees this winter, and I hope you will stick with it. Do not give up. I always have a little wave of patron cancellations in January, and that always makes me sad, because now some people will write and say, hey, you know, like, believe me, I can relate. Hey, my finances have changed. I can't be a patron anymore. And I totally understand. And there's no problem to that. There will always be, the majority of this podcast will always be free and open to everyone. But a lot of people don't say anything. And I always wonder, and some people do say, I lost all my bees, I'm not doing it anymore. And that is so sad to me. It's so sad that, unfortunately, new beekeepers are, you know, if I hate to say this, but new beekeepers are so often set up to fail by businesses that want to sell packages and nukes, or businesses that want to sell you all this hive equipment and all this beekeeping garb that you probably are not going to need. And so it breaks my heart to hear when people have gone out, spent the money, maybe they did the time and the class and all that, and then their bees dies and they're like, forget it. This is too expensive. And beekeeping is expensive if you do it alone. If you do it in groups, it can be remarkably inexpensive if you do it carefully. I can do it in a group and it still be expensive, but my girls have paid off all their equipment. They've paid off their shed. They have, and so, you know, they have a little savings account that they have put aside for me to go crazy with buying some specialty queens from special breeders now and then. And other than that, I don't have to buy too much. I mean, I do have to buy winter patties if I'm going to use them and sugar sometimes. But other than that, I don't really have to buy anything. So it hasn't been that hard at the scale that I'm at, which is tiny. I'm still aiming to keep between about 8 and a dozen hives, and they can pay for themselves. And if I put my mind to it and actually get some honey and actually sell some nukes, then there's a little extra cookie jar money. And to the people who've written to the email and I have not answered, I have such a backlog and I'm slow and I'm distractible. So I'm just terrible about answering back. But I am making an appointment with myself to show up on Patreon every week and to see if anyone sent me questions or if someone has put questions in the comments on things. So if you are on Patreon and you have asked a question that I somehow failed to answer, please message me again, because I'm on my schedule now of checking in there regularly. Thank you to everyone. I hope you have a wonderful couple of weeks. I hope you are getting excited about bee season. Even if bad things happened in your bee yard over the winter, please don't give up. Stick with it. Be determined to be resolute and resilient and determined enough to be a beekeeper, because you'll have to be all those things to be a beekeeper. But I'll tell you, learning about all that, learning about the resolve and the time and the discipline that it takes to be a good beekeeper has really helped me in my life outside of beekeeping. And so I wish that for you. I wish you a beautiful spring if you're in the zones that are having those. And I look forward to hearing from more of you and how your bees are doing. All right. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.